Howdy neighbors, Ron Hayes with you today. It's another Ag Perspectives podcast for you. And today we have some special comments that we were able to pick up from Greg Dowd, Chief Ag Trade Negotiator for the United States Trade Representative's Office of the Trump Administration. He was speaking to the National Association of Farm Broadcasters annual Washington Watch fly-in this week on Tuesday in our nation's capital during meetings at the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Greg Dowd addressed several areas of importance to agriculture in his comments with farm broadcasters, and as you might expect, he begins with the issue of China.
Well, good to see all of you. It's unique to have all of you here in this room, here at the USDA. And, you know, there are just a couple things going on in agricultural trade these days. And it's been an extraordinary time to be in this role at this time. I've been doing this now for about 14 months or so, and we have been historically and extraordinarily busy at this time, and it's been a pleasure. I know earlier today you heard from Undersecretary for Trade Ted McKinney. Ted and I have been in a lot of meetings together and had a lot of conversations about all of the things going on here, and so I just want to give you some perspective today on where we are, strictly from an agricultural standpoint, however, not the overarching issues. And obviously where we begin this conversation today is with China. And I know everybody is, you know, wants to have a resolution to this issue, and believe me, no one wants to have more of a resolution to this than I do. The hours and hours that we've spent on this, and I think we begin this by the basic premise that in agriculture we have the most to gain from an agreement with China, and we also have the most to lose without an agreement with China. Ted and I have, and we've been on most of these together. We've had the first conversation just about a year ago in Beijing, and since that time, we've had about 20 or 21 negotiating sessions with my counterpart, Vice Minister of Agriculture Han Jun. These conversations have been historic, in my opinion. We have spent hours and hours and hours together talking about an enormous number of issues in agriculture. And I want to put this in some context for you today to help you understand the scope and the magnitude of issues just in agriculture. So we exported $19.6 billion worth of agricultural products to China in 2017, and it dropped significantly, obviously, in 2018 to $9.3 billion, even though overall U.S. ag exports last year were up $2 billion to about $145 billion. To put that in context, let's talk about China for a minute. In 2018, China's total agricultural imports were $124 billion. So total U.S. ag exports, $145. Total Chinese imports of agricultural products, $124. So in a good year, we're getting 20 out of 124 of what China imports. And the point I've made from the beginning of this conversation and continue to make with my counterpart in China is that 20 out of 124 just isn't going to cut it. And the frank fact of the matter is, yes, we import or export to China somewhere around $13 billion worth of soybeans. But if you look through all of the other commodities, whether it's wheat, corn, soybeans, rice, ethanol, distiller's grains, dairy products, we could go into a lot of different products here on the beef, pork, and poultry side of the equation. We have almost no access. Let me repeat that. We have almost no access in most of these other commodities. And in fact, here is a very telling statistic. In just the month of March, month before last, the most recent trade data, China imported $965 million worth of beef, pork, and poultry combined. They're now importing almost $1 billion in meat a month. How much of that came from the United States, of that $965 million. Anybody tell me? $35 million. $35 million out of that $965 million came from the United States. And that is a point that I have consistently made in these conversations, is that is not going to cut it. We have to resolve these structural issues in agriculture between our two countries. We have spent hours and hours and hours in these conversations. We've made progress, but we have to have an overall deal in order for this to kick in. And so let's talk about, you know, just some of the components quickly of this overall discussion. What are the issues that we're discussing here overall? And that is the ways in which U.S. companies are pressured to transfer technology to Chinese companies. We're talking about the need for stronger protection and enforcement of intellectual property, the number of tariff and non-tariff barriers faced by U.S. companies in China. That includes agriculture. The harm resulting from China's cyber theft and confidential business information. The need to remove market barriers and tariffs that limit U.S. sales of manufactured goods, services, and agriculture to China. And the role of currency valuation and the U.S.-China trading relationship. I also want to mention in my remarks the fact that and while we've been having these conversations in the last couple of months here, let me give you that. We at the United States has won two very significant WTO cases versus China. One of them, I would argue, maybe one of the, other than Boeing and Airbus, probably one of the biggest WTO cases in history in agriculture, and that was in terms of China's domestic supports. And this was in the areas of corn and rice. Now, what the WTO ruled was that China had already reformed their corn program. And I think that's fair to say, is that at one point China was subsidizing its corn producers by somewhere in excess of $9 a bushel. Well, we all know if you give any farmer in the world $9 a bushel to grow a bushel of corn, what he's going to do? He's going to produce himself out of house and home. And that's exactly what China did, to a point where China couldn't even afford it anymore. They changed that right in front of the WTO case. But what China, or what the WTO clearly agreed with the United States on, was that China was clearly exceeding what it was allowed to do when it became a member of the WTO in 2001 in terms of its subsidies to its farmers. And in fact, in wheat and rice alone, somewhere around $84 billion, they spent more than $84 billion more than they were allowed to do. That's an enormous sum. The other WTO case that we recently won with regard to how China administers its tariff rate quotas. Now, to quickly explain, a tariff rate quota is when a certain quantity comes in at a low tariff rate, and after you hit that quantity, then the tariff increases to a much higher rate. So it's a tiered tariff system. And when China became a member of the WTO in 2001, they agreed to import 9.6 million tons of wheat, 7.2 million tons of corn, and 5.3 million tons of rice, not from the U.S., but from the world. From others in the world, and they've never done that. And in fact, most estimate that if China would actually follow through and import these quantities of these three types of grains as they should have, that's somebody is going to be able to export to China about $3.5 billion a year more in rice, wheat, or corn. So these are two cases that are going to be the benefit of not just U.S. farmers, but every farmer in the world here. And China has indicated that, at least in the case of domestic supports, that they're not going to fight this. They understand that changes have to be made. And, in fact, in the case of corn, they've already made some changes. And hopefully we'll see them follow through on that. With regard to where we're at overall in these negotiations, obviously we're not going to talk about that publicly. But I do want to mention and kind of walk you through the latest conversations here with regard to the tariffs that the United States is going to put on China. So recall back in September of 2018, the tariff rate, we were discussing a tariff rate increase from 10% to 25% on $200 billion worth of Chinese imports. That was delayed on December 1 and then suspended until further notice on March the 5th of this year. Then President Trump recently indicated, and this tariff increase from 10 to 25% did go into effect on May 10th. On May 10th, we also announced that the president has directed us to begin the process for imposing tariffs on essentially all the remaining imports from China, which are valued at somewhere around $300 billion. The details of that process are now available on USTR's website, and I think will be posted in the Federal Register here at some point this week. So I don't want to go into all the details of that, but it's going to be a hearing and written comments and post-hearing rebuttal, part of our normal process to do that. But I want to make a very important point here. The objective of these tariffs is to not hurt China's economic growth or contain China's development, but to find an enforceable solution to China's market-distorting policies and practices that have harmed the U.S. economy and victimized American workers, farmers, ranchers, and businesses. You heard me talk about all of these issues. This is something that has been going on for quite some time, and it's time that this get addressed. One final comment that I will make here today is with regard to African swine fever in China. I know you've all began to discuss this in your circles in agriculture, and I will tell you that I think this is going to be a topic that gets a lot more attention going forward. And I want to give you some context to this conversation to the best of my understanding, the way it's been explained to me. And that is, if China, you know, China has over 600 million hogs, over half the hogs on the planet are in China. And to put that in context, if China were to lose somewhere around 16% of their hogs, that would be the equivalent of all the pork traded in the world. So 16% of China's hogs is roughly equal to global pork trade. If China were to lose 30% of its hogs, that would be roughly equivalent to all the hogs in the United States. I don't know where things stand in China today with regard to these losses, but I will tell you anecdotally, I get information every day, and the numbers are really remarkable. And I think this is something all of us in agriculture need to keep a very close eye on. I think it has major implications with regard to China's demand for feed grains and oil seeds, and also China's demand for meat going forward. I think this has, you know, I don't want to overhype this. I don't want to embellish on this at all. I just want to make the point that this is going to be a very significant topic going forward for us, not just in China, but for agriculture globally. Shifting gears here a little bit, I want to talk a little bit about some of the other things that we're working on. You know, in late 2018, the United States published comprehensive negotiating objectives covering everything from improved market access for American agriculture and industrial goods to innovative rules of origin to ensure the benefits of the agreements actually flow to workers. That was our TPA process, and we talked about TPA in terms of USMCA and Japan and the EU. I want you to know that we are very active now with regard to Japan and having conversations about agriculture in Japan. And the way I've always described this is, in ag circles, it's like two guys running away from a bear. You've heard that old story, you know, two guys running away from, you don't have to outrun the bear, you just have to outrun the other guy, right? Well, right now the other guy is Canada and Australia and even the EU that have had deals that have kicked in with Japan. They're clear over the hill, and we've got to figure out a way to get back even with them as quickly as we possibly can. I just want all of you to know this is an enormous issue for us at USTR. This is a top priority that we're working on every day, and Ambassador Lighthizer is working on every day, and I very much appreciate the attention that he has paid to this. With regard to USMCA, let's talk about that for a little bit. We've now passed two major milestones, in my opinion, in moving the ball forward on this. First of all, Mexico is, and its legislature have made changes to its labor laws, which was kind of a prerequisite to this. It's passed their legislature, been signed, and is now into law. The other one is the International Trade Commission study that was released on April the 18th. That was a big step forward in this process, and I think it, quite frankly, surprised many of us, including myself. It shows that USMCA will create or increase employment by 176,000 jobs and an increase of the GDP by 0.35%. What does that mean in the broader context of things? USMCA changes of a GDP increase of 0.35%. TPP that we all talk about, it only had a GDP increase of 0.15%. So just these minor tweaks and changes that we made in USMCA with regard to things like automobiles, et cetera, has more than double the impact on our economy than what we were doing overall in TPP. And on the agricultural side of it, most of the tariffs were already at zero. So all we were really working on was dairy with Canada, poultry with Canada a little bit here. And even with that, the ITC found that U.S. ag exports were going to increase somewhere around $2.2 billion, with dairy getting a nice chunk of that, with the exports to Canada up $227 million and exports to Mexico up $50 million. Poultry meat exports to Canada up $183.5 million. So not bad, for just, a few tweaks around the edges here. We do have an issue that we still have to get resolved here at some point in this process with regard to the steel and aluminum 232 tariffs and the relationship we have in steel and aluminum with Canada and Mexico. I can tell you that there is not a day that goes by at USTR that somebody isn't having a conversation with Canada or Mexico to try to figure out how to sort this out. This is an enormous priority for us. This has been challenging and has taken more time than I think we would have liked with regard to the new administration and change in administration in Mexico. And, of course, we're now approaching what we here in Washington refer to as the silly season when we have an election coming. That process is evolving now in Canada, which makes it challenging up there as well. But I want you to know that this is something that USTR is working on, and it's really, really important. I think the final point that we need to make on USMCA is just simply that if this agreement is judged on its merits, we are confident that it will easily receive congressional approval. We are looking forward to a vote on this year so we can have America's farmers, ranchers, and workers and businesses begin enjoying the benefits of this agreement. We have worked really, really hard on USMCA. It's with regard to whatever part of the economy, whatever part of this agreement you want to talk about, it's either the same or better across the board. And I think in the conversations that certainly that I've had on Capitol Hill, there's been a lot of receptivity. And I know the ag groups have been in town this spring and have really, really spent the shoe leather up there working on the importance of USMCA and getting this done. And I appreciate very much everyone's efforts. I think we've made a really significant headway. And my colleague Garrett is here to kind of give you some context on all this. Garrett went back and looked. I asked him, I said, when was our last trade vote of any significance up on Capitol Hill? And it was the U.S.-Korean Free Trade Agreement in early 2012. And I said, okay, how many new members of the House do we have since we last had a trade vote in early 2012? And he looked it up, and the answer is 248 of the 435 are new since we had that last vote. And so the point is, this isn't as much a Republican or Democrat issue as it is just educating new members on the importance of trade and the importance of trade in agriculture. And I think, again, folks have done a really, really good job working on that. Lastly, I want to just raise a couple of issues. We haven't just worked on China in recent months. I made a couple trips down to Brazil, one before the change in administration one after, really working on them to resolve some issues with regard to a wheat tariff rate quota issue that, they only agreed to do 24 or 5 years ago and never implemented. We're still, when the President Bolsonaro was here, he agreed to do this. We still are trying to get them to implement this change. So the point is that, you have to be a little persistent, maybe is the right word to use here, with our trading partners from time to time to help them understand that there are things that we need to move forward. We're also continuing to have conversations with them with regard to ethanol. That is an extraordinarily important market for U.S. ethanol. We import a lot of ethanol from Brazil. We export a lot of ethanol to Brazil. You might find it interesting to know that the tariff is not the same between the two. Our tariff is significantly lower than theirs is, and that's a problem. And I remind them, I remind Brazil of that every opportunity that I get, that we need to resolve that issue. Speaking of reminders, we are also have done something pretty extraordinary with India that needs to be talked about from time to time. We have done something in agriculture called a counter notification for the first time, and that was a year ago. My first trip to Geneva, I slid a piece of paper across the table to the Indian ambassador to the WTO. I said, you've reported that your subsidies on wheat and rice and cotton and chickpeas and pigeon peas and mung beans and lentils has been this. Well, we went back and looked at your own websites, and in the case of wheat, we found that your subsidies were actually 7 or 8 times what you were allowed to do in the WTO. In the case of rice, 6 or 7 times what you were allowed to do. So we're going to call you out on it and help the world understand that, maybe there's a reason India is the largest rice exporter in the world these days. Maybe it's because of subsidies. And, we also have to keep an eye on what India may do here in the coming year with regard to wheat exports as well. So I think this administration, what I appreciate, and my boss, Ambassador Lighthizer, is putting some folks on notice that from an enforcement standpoint, we expect folks to live up to what they've agreed to do. In the case of China, they hadn't reported to the WTO what their subsidies were since 2012 until a couple months ago. That's pretty outrageous when you stop and think about it. Folks are really, they get on us anytime we miss any letter of the law, and so I think it's just fair that we do the same. The other thing that Ambassador Lighthizer is really frustrated about, and this is really appropriate when it comes to agriculture, is did you realize that, when you have a developing country status at the WTO, and you can self-declare whether you're a developing country or a developed country, you get special rights and privileges, and you don't have to live up to the letter of domestic subsidies and market access that we do. It's interesting that half of the G20 is a developing country in this regard. And, I've heard Ambassador Lighthizer say in meetings, he said, well, maybe the United States just ought to declare ourselves a developing country, and then it would be back to even again. And I think that's a fair point. One last thing I'm going to raise here that's something that we are keeping an eye on is we noticed here the other day that Vietnam announced that it was planning to ban glyphosate. And I think some of you in the ag media have taken notice of that. This is something that we've got to keep an eye on. The good news is Vietnam has shown a willingness to accept U.S. scientific information and has clarified that there will be a transition period in which glyphosate will still be allowed to use there through June of 2020. We also know that France has recently announced that by the end of next year they planned to make some very significant changes, but they also plan to have some exceptions. So I'm not quite sure exactly what that means. In closing, I want to share something with you that I shared the other day in some conversations at the Farm Foundation. And I don't think anybody believed me. So I'm going to say it again. One of my colleagues at USTR who works on pesticide issues and environmental issues and nutrition issues and the multinational and multilateral setting, she was recently in Europe having a conversation about pesticides. And she was joined by someone from the U.S. EPA. And the U.S. EPA person spoke up and said, you know, Europe, if you ban some of the newer pesticides and newer technology, that's going to result in farmers going back and using the older technology that's harder on the environment. And their European colleague's response was, yeah, well, we're planning on banning that too. And they said, in fact, our opinion is that for agriculture and pesticide use, all we really need is vinegar, milk, and beer. And, you know, I know, like I said the other day, I some of your reaction, you were in the room, was like, Craig's kidding. That can't be true. I can tell you that following up in the conversations with my colleagues, the Europeans were serious. At least those regulatory officials, in their opinion, were serious about what they said. This situation is extraordinary, in my opinion, and it has really surprised me in my time in this position of how obstinate and how backward-looking folks in Europe are with regard to agriculture. You know, I've heard Secretary Perdue refer to the Museum of Agriculture, that is the EU. I think this is something that all of us need to just not dismiss. I think it's something that we all need to work on and be cognizant of and help folks understand that. And I've actually made this point with my Chinese counterpart in conversations. I've said, look, you have to understand, the American farmer, when he wakes up in the morning, thinks about how he's going to feed 9 billion people by 2050. That's our mindset in the United States. No, I know that's not the mindset of the French farmer or his government, but that's our mindset in the United States, and we fully intend and expect to use the best and safest technology at our disposal to do that. And I think all of us need to not take for granted that we'll be able to do that. We have to be able to educate everyone involved in this conversation now and going forward on the best way to do that and the safest way to do that, to provide the safest and most wholesome food in the world, because that's what we do. Yes, sir.
Senator Grassley, the chair of the committee, has said there won't be a vote on USMCA unless the 232s are gone. I can understand the metals industry wants to protect their jobs, and agriculture wants to have USMCA. How soon? What's the process of advancing and getting past the 232?
It's a great question, and the answer is there isn't a day that goes by that we're not working on that very issue to resolve that. I can't go into details, but I can tell you there's conversation just about every day with Mexico on how to resolve this, and with Canada on how to resolve this. Progress has been made, but I can't tell you when we're going to get this done. I don't know the answer to that. Again, I'm just the agricultural person. I'm not the steel person.
And maybe this is two different things, too. First, I wanted to address the USMCA, and I wanted to know what is holding up the administration from releasing more information to Congress to review. And then secondly, can you give us more of an update on the U.S.-Japan discussions and where we're at there?
The answer on USMCA is this is a process, and you know there are documents that have to be brought forward. I don't think there's any effort on our part to delay things at all. I think it's just getting the I's dotted and T's crossed, and hopefully we'll be able to move forward on that very, very quickly. With regard to Japan, I can tell you that Ambassador Lighthizer continues to have conversations on a very regular basis. I would say at this point we're still in what in trade lingo terms we would call a scoping exercise in terms of what's going to be involved in the context of the discussion. Clearly, agriculture is an enormous priority for us here, and we've already discussed why. But I think there are other components of this that they're still talking about to figure out what this is going to look like. But hopefully this can be moved forward as quickly as we can possibly get it done.